Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Good, the Bad, and the Uncanny by Simon R. Green, narrated by Dan Kelly. 1. Into the Dragon's Mouth. I was out and about that night, taking my trench coat for a walk, when a sudden fog came rolling down the street towards me like a grim grey tidal wave. I stopped and studied its progress cautiously. We don't get many fogs in the night side. We get lots of rain and thunderstorms and the occasional hail of frogs, but we don't really do weather as such. Weather and seasons are part of the natural order of the world, and we don't really do natural either. So a sudden fog always means trouble for someone. People on the street were already running ahead of the fog or disappearing into sheltering doorways as the thick pearl grey wall rolled relentlessly on, enveloping clubs and shops and soaking up the neon light till only the merest technicolour glints showed through, like so many half-blinded eyes. A growing silence moved with the fog as it ate up all the life and laughter in the street. I could see dim shapes moving, caught in the thick mists, struggling slowly like insects caught in hardening amber. The fog smeared itself across shop windows, filling the night and hanging heavily on the air, surging forward in sudden, billowing clouds. Up close, the pearly grey mists were full of shimmering sparks and uncertain shapes that came and went in a moment. I seriously considered running. This had all the makings of a flux fog. Such things are dangerous. A flux fog means the corners of the world aren't properly nailed down anymore, and reality is up for grabs. Inside a flux fog, all certainties are thrown into question, and all the possibilities that ever were are suddenly made equal. Take the wrong turning in a grey world where every turn looks just like every other, and you could end up walking out of the fog into a whole new place, with no guarantee you'll ever find a way home again. Everything looks blurred and out of focus in a flux fog because you're seeing a dozen different dimensions, 100 possibilities for every object or person or direction. People and places can change subtly even as you approach them. Familiar faces can become strangers, and in the blink of an eye, you're trapped in a world that never knew you. The only real defense against a flux fog is not to be there when one manifests. I should have known better than to be out and about on such a night. The weather forecast had been changeable with a side order of on your own head be it. But I felt the need to go out, to walk up and down the night side, to see what there was to be seen and think a few very private thoughts. Some thoughts can only be properly considered when you've removed yourself from your comfort zone. A melancholy had come upon me over a period of weeks, and I wasn't sure why. Things were actually going well for a change. I was wealthy enough that I could pick and choose my cases, pursuing only those that interested me, and I was respected enough that no one had tried to kill me in weeks, and Susie and I were closer than ever. I had everything I'd ever dreamed of, so why was I so restless? Why was I waiting for the hammer to fall? Susie was out pursuing a case of her own, hunting down some poor bastard for the bounty on his head, and the house had seemed very still and quiet without her in it. I felt strangely agitated, disturbed, uneasy, as though someone, somewhere, had me in his gun sight. So I left the house and went for a walk, to think and brood, and hopefully tempt any possible enemy out into the open, where I could get at him. And what I got for my trouble was a flux fog. The mists really were getting quite close now. People stepped out of the grey wall before me, vague and indistinct, their details only firming up as they left the fog behind them. A giant teddy bear in a World War I British Army uniform looked confusedly about him, clutching his rifle with his furry paws. A scientific person in a pristine white lab coat stalked right past me, gabbling to himself in low Coptic, and a gaggle of Russian tourists in Chernobyl Health Spa t-shirts started to take photographs of me before they realized who I was and decided to take a sudden interest in something else instead. Nothing out of the ordinary for the night side, where some days you can't trust anyone or anything to stay the same for 10 minutes in a row. All the people here have some nasty little secrets, something cold and unpleasant clutched greedily to their bosoms, some special need or fascination that could only be revealed and satisfied in the neon-lit streets of the night side. A private face behind every public mask, a hidden meaning peeking through whatever words they choose to share with you. Even I had turned out to be, not who I thought I was, Lilith's son. The flux fog surged forward, filling the street, and I opened my arms to it, embracing the bitter, tingling mists as they rolled over me. A reckless, stupid thing to do, but the restlessness was so great in me, I felt a desperate need to do something, anything out of character, just to prove to myself that I was still in charge of my life, that I was still making the decisions. The mists felt hot and clammy, like the steam in a sick room, where the fever burns like madness and inspiration all at once. Shadowy shapes skittered all around me, like sharks circling a body in the water, and somewhere far away, a great bell made of ice tolled the hours before dawn. And then, just like that, the fog was gone. The street was back, in all its wild and gaudy details, the clubs and bars and private establishments as loud and raucous as ever. The bright primary colours of the neon signs blazed as sleazily as ever, and the huge oversized moon shone coldly in the clear night sky. People spilled back out onto the pavements, once again intent only on tracking down their own particular heavens and hells, their very own private rewards and damnations. Nothing had changed, least of all me. I lowered my arms, feeling faintly foolish and obscurely disappointed. The flux fog hadn't touched me, perhaps because of my not altogether human nature, perhaps because it was afraid of me, or perhaps because it wouldn't deign to touch anyone who wanted it. Why was I so restless, that night of all nights? Why did I want so badly for my life to change? Was it because I'd finally got everything I ever wanted, and all I could think was, is this it? Perhaps fortunately, my mobile phone rang, playing Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells. I finally got rid of the Twilight Zone theme. You can run some jokes into the ground. I took out my phone, hit the exorcism function to keep out the really determined ad mail, and did my best to speak cheerfully and normally. Hi there. You have reached John Taylor, private investigator, hero for hire, and female impersonator for private functions. This may or may not be a recording. Speak now.
Oh, God, you're in one of your moods again, aren't you?
Said my secretary, Kathy.
I don't know why you ever try to sound cheerful. You know you're no good at it. I, on the other hand, am always bright and cheerful and charming because I'm young and fresh and still relatively unsullied.
She had a point. Kathy was so unrelentingly cheerful, I used to think she dosed herself morning, noon and night with every drug known to man. But no, it was just her. There ought to be a law. What do you want, Kathy? I said patiently. You're interrupting my quality time.
Oh, you're not going to believe this one, boss.
What have you done this time?
Nothing, or at least nothing you need to worry about. But you won't believe you just found the office looking to hire you. An elf. Really, he could have knocked me down with a French tickler. Not only has an elf lord come to the night side, which is weird and scary and disturbing enough in itself, but he wants you to solve a case for him. How cool is that?
Which particular elf lord are we talking about here? I said, since one of us had to be practical and professional in this conversation, and it clearly wasn't going to be Kathy.
Says he's the Lord Screech, but you can bet good money that's not his real name. Elves lie like they breathe. They only come into our world to mess us over.
Of course, I said, it's all they've got left. What exactly does this putative Lord Screech want me to find for him?
Wouldn't say, sniffed Kathy. Too far up himself to discuss details with a mere underling. Says he'll be at the Dragon's Mouth for the next 2 hours if you'd care to drop by for a little chat. No mention of money, but he's an elf. When did you last hear one of them lowering himself to ask a mere human for help?
Never, I said, which would suggest that not only is this case going to be impossible, unethical, and quite mind-bogglingly dangerous, but I'll probably end up stabbed in the back by my own client.
Well, of course, said Kathy. I thought that was all understood when I said your client is an elf. But come on, boss, we are talking major bragging rights here. You could dine out on this for months. John Taylor, the private investigator, so special that even the high and mighty elves come to him to solve their problems. We could have new cards made.
Still, I said, why the Dragon's Mouth? That's a seriously unpleasant place, even for the night side. What would an elf be doing there? What does he know? That I know the Dragon's Mouth, that once upon a time I knew it very well.
You used to frequent the Dragon's Mouth, boss?
Said Kathy, somehow managing to sound scandalised and delighted at the same time.
But it's...
The Nightside's premier drug den, I said. You never knew me in my dog days, Kathy, when I was down and out and on the run from everyone, including myself. I swore I'd never go back, but if that's where the elf is, then that's where I'm going. If only because I can't have our crafty and underhanded elf lord thinking he has an advantage over me. No one tells me there's somewhere I can't go. Not even me.
You're weird, boss.
I shut down the phone and put it away. I'd gone out into the night looking for changes, and it seemed I'd found some. I've been thinking about my future,
but it seemed my past wasn't finished with me yet. I thrust both hands deep into the pockets of my trench coat, took a deep breath, and headed for the dragon's mouth, and the deepest, darkest part of the night. Never trust elves. They always have their own agenda. There are places you just don't go in the night side, either because they're so dangerous you know you're going to have to fight your way in, and probably out, or because they're so extreme, so shameful, and so damned sickening that no one with any sense would have anything to do with them. There are bad places, dangerous places, and unhealthy places. And then there's the dragon's mouth. Tucked away casually in a shadowy side street not far from the old main drag, the club's exterior really is a huge dragon's head, some 30 feet tall and 20 wide, its huge gaping jaws forming the entrance. Rumour had it the dragon had been petrified centuries ago by the Gorgon Medusa herself, in which case, I hated to think what they were using for the back door. The wide stone head was a smooth, dull grey, untouched by time or weather. The eyes were deep, dark hollows. Great jagged teeth pointed up and down like stalagmites and stalactites. There were no exterior guards. Just walk in, whenever you please. All are welcome for as long as their money or credit holds out. Anything goes, any need satisfied. Enter at your own risk and abandon hope all ye, well, I'm sure you know the rest. I strolled unhurriedly between the two long rows of teeth and descended the winding stone stairs into the belly of the beast, the huge stone chamber spread out beneath the street. It was years since I'd last been here, a lifetime. It was yesterday. Sometimes you do things to yourself so bad that the memories have barbs and never let you go. I'd known what that place was all those years ago and what it could do to me, but I'd descended into hell anyway. I'd come here because what it offered was what I wanted, the slow, sweet suicide of addiction. I was so much younger then, and beset on all sides by threats and questions and destinies I couldn't face anymore. So I ran away, from friends and enemies alike, buried myself in the delightful depths of the dragon's mouth, and gave myself to a very harsh and demanding mistress. I'd still be there, if Razor Eddie hadn't come and got me out. No one says no to the punk god of the straight razor. I stayed with him for a while, with all the other homeless who washed up in Rat's Alley. I thought I couldn't fall any further, until Susie Shooter came looking for me, for the price on my head, and I ran headlong from the night side and everything in it, with Susie's bullet burning in my back. I thought I was done with the night side forever, but destiny called me home, where I belonged, with all the other monsters. I descended the smooth stone steps into the great cavern below, and it all looked just as I remembered. As though I'd merely stepped out for a moment, and all the last years of my life had been only another smoke dream. I stopped at the bottom of the steps and looked about me, fighting to keep my face calm and unconcerned. The stone chamber was packed with people, standing and sitting and lying down, but the whole buzz of conversation was little more than a susurrus of whispers. You didn't come to the dragon's mouth to talk. The air was thick with 100 kinds of narcotic smoke, and already my lips and nostrils were going numb. You could experience a dozen different highs just strolling round the room, and long-buried parts of me stirred slowly, awakening, remembering. I took a deep breath. The smoky air smelled of sour milk and brimstone. I smiled slowly, and I knew it wasn't a pleasant smile. Some of the people there recognized me. They smiled and nodded, or scowled and made the sign against the evil eye. And some crept further back into the concealing shadows, but nobody said anything. Nobody did anything. Held tightly in the jealous arms of their own particular mistresses, they trusted the club's staff to see that they remained undisturbed. There was never any trouble in the dragon's mouth, because on the few occasions anyone was stupid enough to start anything, old Mother Connor would take measures, very extreme and unpleasant measures. She sat where she always sat, behind an ornately carved restoration desk, right at the bottom of the entrance steps. You couldn't see the top of the desk for all the piled-up currency, gold, jewels and credit cards. Mother Connell sat at her ease in a frighteningly huge padded chair, 400 pounds of overwhelming femininity, wrapped in a purple toga topped off with a long pink feather boa, draped loosely around her huge wattled neck. Sometimes the boa stirred, as though it were alive, or dreaming. Mother Connell dominated anywhere she was just by being there, through the sheer force of her appalling personality, and her complete willingness to make use of her mallet-sized fists at the first hint of any unpleasantness. Harsh and sweaty under an obviously fake curly blonde wig, her wide red face was marked by heavily mascaraed eyes and a scarlet gash of her mouth, along with heavy jowls that disappeared into the pink feather boa. I always thought she looked like she'd just eaten half a dozen drag queens for breakfast. She had a smile for everyone because a smile cost nothing, but it wasn't a pretty sight. Her huge hands moved restlessly over the piled-up wealth before her, endlessly counting and sorting and rearranging it. In a rare moment of companionship, she once told me that when the cash really came rolling in, there was so much that she didn't have time to count it, so she weighed it. She looked up and caught my eye. Mother Connell never forgot her face and never took any goodbye as final. Her scarlet lips pulled back to reveal yellow teeth, and she beckoned me over with one meaty hand. Her voice was deep and harsh, like a dog growling.
"Hello again, Mr. T. Been a while. Still looking for your Shanghai Lil."
"That was long ago, in another land. And besides, the wench is dead," I said. "I understand you're letting in elves these days." Her smile disappeared in a moment.
"Hard times, Mr. T. Decadence and debauchery isn't what it was. I blame television."
"Tell me at least you didn't let him pay you with fairy gold." She cackled briefly.
"Not likely, Mr. T. He had a MasterCard."
"Oh, very appropriate," I murmured. "Where can I find this elf, Mother Connell?" She stabbed a meaty finger at the back of the room, her heavy underarms swinging ponderously.
"In the smoking section, Mr. T. Do us all a favour. Get him the hell out of here. He's lowering the bleeding tone something awful."
"Well, naturally," I said. I waggled my fingers in a goodbye, and she grinned back at me like a shark scenting blood in the water. I turned away, with a certain sense of relief, and moved off into the cavern, drifting deeper into the depths of the dragon's mouth. No one paid me any attention, as they were all sunk deep in their own personal heavens and hells. But one man saw me, and knew me, and came striding daintily out of the smoky mists with his professional smile of greeting fixed firmly in place. No one knew precisely how old the host was, or even if he was, technically speaking, human. He'd been with the dragon's mouth since it opened, over a century and a half ago. The host was there to make you feel welcome, to see to your every need, and to see that you got everything that was coming to you. He'd find you somewhere comfortable, help you with the pipe or the pills, or the needle or the tourniquet, whisper suggestions in your ear when you looked to be hesitating, and encourage you to try things you'd never even contemplated before. He'd cuddle you when the shakes were bad, hold your hair back as you vomited, and take you for every penny you had. And when you died in the dragon's mouth, his would be the last face you ever saw, still smiling. Do I really need to tell you why? He was currently wearing the very best suit Savile Row had to offer, complete with an old-school tie I was pretty sure he wasn't entitled to wear. He painted his face stark white with arsenic. His smiling mouth was crimson with heavy lipstick, and his dark, shining eyes never blinked once. His jet-black hair had been slicked down so fiercely it looked painted on, and a small silver ankh hung from his left earlobe. His every movement and gesture were elegance personified, and he moved through the world as though everyone in it was merely a supporting player to his star turn. The host could get you anything, anything at all, and the worse it was for you, the wider he smiled. The host was always delighted to be of service. He'd been only too happy to supply me with what I thought I needed all those years ago. He drifted to a halt before me, bowed ever so politely, and clasped his pale, long-fingered hands together across his sunken chest.
"Well, well,"
he said in a happy, breathy voice, positively brimming with artificial bonhomie and fake sincerity.
"Back again, Mr. Taylor. How nice. We're always happy to welcome back one of our straying sons. What can I get you, Mr. Taylor? Your usual?"
"No," I said. "I'm not here for that. I'm here to meet someone." His dark red smile widened, just a little.
"That's what they all say. Don't be shy, Mr. Taylor. You're amongst friends here. There's nothing to be ashamed of in the dragon's mouth. Indulge yourself. It's what we're here for."
"It's not what I'm here for," I said steadily. "I'm here on business, so stand aside." He didn't move, his unblinking eyes fixed on mine, his gaze full of a malign intensity.
"No one ever leaves the dragon's mouth, Mr. Taylor. Not really. They only pop out for a while, then they come back. Who else knows you as well as us? Who else can provide you with what you really need? You belong here, Mr. Taylor. You know you do. Come with me. Let me lead you to your old cubicle. It's still here. Nothing has changed. Let me prepare the needle for you and pop up a vein. You never really left. The world outside was just a cruel dream. You've always been here, where you belong.
I laughed right in his face, and he actually fell back a step. Dream on, I said. I'm a lot more than I used to be. The host rallied almost immediately.
Are you sure I can't offer you a little taste, Mr. Taylor? On the house, of course.
Don't tempt me, I said. The host stepped gracefully to one side, bowing his head, admitting defeat. For the moment.
Be seeing you, Mr. Taylor.
Not if I see you first, I said to his elegantly retreating back. I looked around the chamber, and various significant details loomed up out of the slowly swirling smoke. The old place hadn't changed since I was here last, hiding from a world that had broken and defeated me in pretty much every way there was. I hadn't so much lost hope as thrown it away, because hope hurt too much. The sheer weight of my life had become too much to carry, and I couldn't stand to see my reflection in the eyes of my friends. I'd failed at everything that mattered and a few things that didn't, so I came here, to the Dragon's Mouth, asking only for pain's ease and forgetfulness. For the one thing drugs could give you that was better than pleasure, the cold, quiet comfort of feeling nothing at all. There were hanging silk curtains and embroidered standing screens to provide privacy for those who still cared about such things. Tables and chairs and camp beds scattered in little clusters, shadowy grottos and cells cut deep into the dark stone walls, blood and piss and vomit on the floor, and all around me, men and women and other things lost in dreams and might have beens. Dying by inches, but I couldn't find it in myself to feel much for any of them. No one comes to the Dragon's Mouth by chance. Everyone knows what happens here. You have to want it and choose it, in the same way you'd choose a gun or a noose or the razor's blade. And I had wanted it so very badly once upon a time. I shook my head hard. I'm not normally one for dwelling in the past or regretting old mistakes. The tainted smoke curling on the still air was getting to me. I moved forward, making my way carefully between the packed tables and chairs and stepping over the occasional dim shape on the floor, looking about me for the elf. A few people turned their backs as I passed them. Either they knew me, or they didn't want to know me. I didn't recognize any faces. Two hides were fighting in a pit gouged raggedly from the stone floor. Over-muscled forms with taut skin and bulging veins, they slammed together again and again, tearing at each other with clawed hands and bared teeth. Blood and sweat coursed down their distorted forms, and they grunted and snarled like beasts, while a few languid spectators roused themselves to lay bets on which hide would survive. The dead hide would be recycled, so as not to waste any of the drug. Junkies know everything there is to know about making a drug go further. A cyborg from some future timeline was mainlining a fierce and nasty future drug called blood. Tech implants protruded from his grey flesh, discharging sudden bursts of static. His eyes glowed golden as they rolled up into his head, and his slack mouth was full of metal teeth. You can fill the future with all the high-tech you want, but people will still be people. A long row of camp beds had been pushed up against one wall, and a dozen or so pretty young things stared sightlessly up into the smoky air, enjoying the complete out-of-the-body experience, courtesy of the banned African drug Tadooku. Blasted loose from the chains of their bodies, their minds were free to drift into the past or the future, or any number of alternate dimensions or realities. Sometimes they came back, and sometimes they didn't. You can probably imagine what happens to the bodies of those who don't come back. Brother Frank was experimenting with angel breath again, the old deep fix, trying to separate out the various levels of his consciousness so he could have conversations with himself. He had to be careful around Brother Frank. He did so love to spike a drink, so to speak. A huge cage with reinforced iron bars held those who had chosen to indulge in the ancient alien drug known as Revert. A sly and deceitful drug that could throw your evolution into reverse, transforming you into the Neanderthal state, or even further, if you could stand it. In the cage, amongst the heavy, low-browed figures, there were other, even more disturbing shapes. And finally, a small and rather furtive group was smoking Martian red weed from hookah pipes. Devotees claim it helps you think in whole new ways. Smoke enough of the stuff, and you can think like a Martian. Smoke too much, and your body will actually turn into a Martian,
and then everyone around you will rise up and club you to death, because even the Nightside has its standards. A couple of soft ghosts wandered through the thick air, hand in hand, looking for anything familiar. They were vague, indistinct, half-transparent, their very existence worn down and eroded by too much travelling in other dimensions. Human once, they had gone too far and seen too much, and now they could no longer remember how to find their way home, or even what home had been like. The details of their faces had grown smooth and doubtful, like the statues of cemetery angels worn down by time and the elements. The smoke ghosts drifted here and there, desperate for a familiar face or an accent, asking in their soft, distant voices of cities and peoples and worlds that no one had ever heard of. The patrons of the Dragon's Mouth flapped them away with heavy hands, or ignored them completely. The soft ghosts should have known better than to look for help here, but they were attracted to the altered states of consciousness like moths to a flame. One of them tugged gently at my sleeve, trying to attract my attention, but I shrugged it off. I'd spotted my elf. I was heading straight for him when someone moved abruptly forward to block my way. I stopped short, because it was either that or walk right over him, then paused to consider the man before me. I knew who he was almost at once, though the years had not been kind. Carnaby Jones, the wide-eyed boy, infamous dandy and free spirit of the old King's Road, had fallen far from what he once was. His T-shirt and jeans were clean enough, but he looked as if someone else had dressed him. His old muscular frame was gone, the flesh sunk right back to the bone, and his skin was a dull, unhealthy yellow. The skull showed clearly behind the taut skin of his face, his deep-set eyes were lost and murky, and his thin-lipped smile held all the malice in the world. He smelled bad. I could still remember when the wide-eyed boy had been the best and bravest. "What do you want, Carnaby?" I asked politely. He sniggered loudly.
"No time for old friends, John. Nothing to say to the old friend you abandoned and left behind. The one who brought you here and taught you the ropes and introduced you to pleasures you never knew existed."
"I forgave you for that long ago," I said. "We're both different people now. Is that a tinge of purple I see in your eyeballs, Carnaby? Been injecting through the tear ducts because you ran out of veins. How could you have fallen so far?"
"Practice,"
he said, his grin widening to show rotten teeth.
"You're looking good, John. Really. Very healthy. What made you think you could just walk back in here and stroll amongst us with your nose in the air? You owe me, John. You know you do."
"You want me to take you out of here, I'll do it," I said. "You want help? I'll get you the best there is."
"I don't want anything from you, except to see you pay for what you did."
"What did I do, Carnaby?" I said patiently.
"You broke the rules, John. You got out. No one's supposed to get out of here. That's the point."
"I had help," I said. "Take my hand, Carnaby. Really, I mean it. The only one keeping you here is you." He looked at me sideways, still smiling his unpleasant smile.
"You got out and now you're a big man in the Nightside. Oh, yes, the news trickles down even to places like this. Word is, you're a rich man, too. So how about a little something for an old friend? How about a handout? How about the shirt off your back? How about everything you've got?"
He was spitting the words out now, his whole wrecked body shaking with years of pent-up, carefully rehearsed spite and hatred. I sensed old Mother Connell stirring behind her table and raised one hand to stop her. Because once upon a time, the wide-eyed boy really had been a friend of mine, had really had it in him to be the very best of us. Drugs don't just destroy who you are, they destroy all the people you might have been. So I stepped forward, grabbed his bony head firmly with both hands, and held his gaze with my own. He tried to break away, but there was no strength left in him. He tried to look away, but I had him. I concentrated, and he cried out miserably as all the old scabs on his forearms broke open and dark liquids oozed out and trickled down his arms. Everything he'd ever taken, every last nasty drop of it, ran out of him, and he cried like a baby at the loss of it. When I was finished, I let him go, and he fell in a heap before me. "There," I said, "you're clean, free as a bird, so you can leave or you can stay. It's all up to you. And don't say I never did anything for you." I left him there and headed for the elf. He was sitting alone at a small table, smoking opium through a hollowed-out human thigh bone, just because he could. There was a circle of open space around him, despite the crowded conditions of the Dragon's Mouth, because even the kind of people who habituated a place like this didn't want anything to do with an...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?